The church has disagreed on how to read this book for a long time.
It's not a story that takes place over 20 chapters. It's a story that is much shorter and is explained from all the different perspectives throughout the 20 chapters.
So scholars have called Revelation a particular genre that we call apocalyptic.
Welcome to Kingdoms Unveiled, where we're pulling back the curtain on the supernatural nature of your faith. We do believe that there's a kingdom of darkness. It is at war with our King, King Jesus. And there is much to know about it. We shouldn't ignore it. And so we're going to continue to have that conversation between two pastors. And your hosts are Doug Van Dorn, who's the pastor of the Reformed Baptist Church in Northern Colorado. This is in Boulder. And I'm John Moffitt. I'm the pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. And if you've just found us because you typed in how to read Revelation, then this probably is your first episode with us, and we're glad that you're here. But this has been really a series that we've been on for this year, trying to explain the supernatural part of the Bible. And it's going to be really, really hard to believe, to read the book of Revelation, if you don't believe that the Bible is supernatural, that there is an actual war. As a matter of fact, I think it would be near impossible, Doug, to read Revelation if you don't believe in the supernatural nature of your faith. So that's really what the podcast is about. And we have covered, starting really in Genesis, helping people think through the counsel of God, the gods, the war between the Nephilim. We've kind of just been working through scripture and wanted to take a break from some of that and talk about a book that Doug, two books actually, that Doug has recently written. So these were published, what, a couple months ago?
Yeah, I suppose 6 months ago, beginning of summer, I think.
Mm-hmm. And there's the book, which we're going to talk about today, and then we'll reference this, the companion guide. And the reason why Doug had to do it this way is because trying to put all these charts and photos and graphs into the book, one, would make it enormous to try and read as it's paperback. But two, it doesn't really work well. And so he created a companion guide. So my encouragement to you is when you do buy this, make sure you get both, because I remember reading it and you referenced the companion guide quite a bit. So yeah, this will kind of help give you some visuals, and the book of Revelation is very visual in nature. So, all right, Doug. So this is a, you know, we've been kind of doing a series. If you want to go back, we introduced this concept of understanding Revelation two episodes ago. So this is really kind of a third one. We're going to pick up where we left off on those, really starting in chapter 20, understanding the millennium. If you understand how the millennium works, and you have a little bit of an understanding of where our perspective is, that's going to lead us into today's chapter. So, Doug, we're definitely not going to talk about everything that's in the first two chapters, but we wanted to give people kind of an appetite and really think through how it is that we can read such a complicated book. So I'm going to throw it over to you and kind of talk to us about there's basically in your book, you argue there's two ways of reading Revelation. Why are there two ways, and explain what those two are, and then we'll start unpacking them.
When people read most books these days, they read them cover to cover. So mm-hmm. chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, chapter four. There's a few kinds of genres of books that you don't read like that, like a auto manual. You're hopefully not going to sit down and just start reading your auto manual chapter by chapter, right?
unless you're stuck with it on a desert island.
Or maybe a dictionary. You don't read a dictionary like that, probably.
No, for sure.
Although I know at least one person who kind of does, but wow, most people don't. So the point of that is that when you come to an auto manual, you understand that it's a certain kind of genre. It's something that when something breaks down, you look it up in the back, you try and find out what the problem is, mm-hmm. you go to that section, and then you're hopefully done, right? Same thing with a dictionary. You have a word that you don't understand what the meaning of it is, and so you open up the part where the word is, and then you're done. Mm-hmm. So novels don't work like that. If you pick up a novel, you're going to start in chapter one, you're going to read till the end of the book, and you're going to go consecutive in right. sequence of the numbers. And this is really how we read most things. I think people actually probably read the newspaper that way a lot. Mm-hmm. I didn't, because I always liked the comics best. And so I would go to the end and then I would go to the sports after that. But some people, you know, they would sit down at night and they would read it cover to cover.
I love how you speak about it in past tense.
Yeah. Newspapers, do they even exist?
Right.
Well, dictionaries, do they even exist either?
Yeah, no. We just use Google online, for everything, right? Now. Yeah, exactly.
It's crazy. So, yeah, I mean, the fact that we even have to say that shows that genre is something that you really have to think through. You have to understand what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. So when you come to the book of Revelation, the main question becomes, how should I read this book? Mm-hmm. And I think most people just kind of assume that you read it the way that you would read a novel. You read it chapter one, then chapter two, then chapter three, and you go all the way to the end. Of course, there's nothing wrong with that. And that's actually how it's meant to be read.
Right.
But is that how it's meant to be interpreted? And that's a different question.
That's correct.
Right. So, this becomes a really, really big deal when, in terms of how we end up coming to our conclusions about what the book means. Mm-hmm. And we'll give a good example here, based on where we came last time. And I'm going to read the end of Revelation 19 and then into chapter 20. And then we'll just kind of talk about that.
Okay.
So it says, then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and with a loud voice, he called to all the birds that fly directly overhead, come gather for the great supper of God and eat the flesh of kings, and the flesh of captains, the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses and their riders, the flesh of all men, both free and slave, both small and great. And I saw a beast and the kings of the earth with their armies gathered to make war against him who was sitting on a horse and against his army. And the beast was captured, and with it, the false prophet who was in its presence. Had done great signs by which he had deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped its image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire that burns with sulfur, and the rest were slain by the sword that came from the mouth of him who's sitting on a horse, and all the birds were gorged with their flesh. Then I saw an angel. Now that's the ESV. You could translate that, and I saw an angel. That's so different. So different. Yeah. We'll talk about that in a bit. I know we've kind of mentioned that before, but let's keep reading. I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. And he seized the dragon, the ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, threw him in the pit, shut it, and sealed it over him so that he might not deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be released for a little while. Then I saw thrones, and seated on them were those to whom authority to judge was committed. I also saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for the testimony of Jesus and for the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or its image and had not received its mark on their foreheads or their hands. They came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. The rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were ended. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who shares in the first resurrection. Over such, second death has no power, but they will be priests of God and of Christ, and they will reign with him for 1,000 years. And when the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. Their number is like the sand of the sea, and they marched up over the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. But fire came down from heaven and consumed them, and the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet were, and they were tormented day and night forever. So what have we just read? Well, we read really kind of four things. We read about a war that seemed to end all things. And then we read about this millennium. And then we were transported into heaven where we see these saints reigning. And they're reigning with Christ for 1,000 years. And then we find another war. And that's what we've seen. So when you assume that the book is to be read consecutively, this is how we come up with this idea of premillennialism and probably postmillennialism as well. Because, well, chapter 20 obviously follows temporally after chapter 19. And that's where that word then in English is so important, because that's a translation of the Greek word kai, which can mean then or and. But when you put then, you are interpreting for the reader that this is to be read most likely temporally, as in consecutively. So I saw this war, and then I saw. So that leads people to conclude, okay, this must be happening right after that. And then again, then I saw these saints. And so that, oh, they must be happy. You know what I'm saying? And then we see another war at the end. And so it, what you have is something along the lines of, in an eschatological point of view, you would have a war, and then you would have a 1,000-year reign of Christ on the earth. And then you would have another war after that, after Satan is released. And so these wars are totally different. Mm-hmm. People just assume that that's how you're to read the book of Revelation, John. And they don't question it. Yeah. And what we want to do here is say that we think that there's lots of reasons to question that that's how you're supposed to be reading the book of Revelation.
Yeah. Is there another genre in the Old Testament? This is something we hadn't talked about, so I'm just going to throw this out there. Is there another example in the Bible where like this, you have to step back and say, okay, I can't read it this way?
Yeah, so the question becomes, what is the genre of Revelation?
Right.
So it's kind of a mixed bag in some ways, because when you read the beginning of it and the end of it, it comes across like it's a letter in the same sort of a way that a letter of Paul is a letter. So we call that an epistle,
churches.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it starts off where it looks like it's an epistle. And so how would you read an epistle or a letter? Well, you'd read it consecutively. But the problem is, almost immediately, it starts going into these incredibly bizarre images. And then these things start repeating over and over in crazy, wild, weird ways, which we'll get into in later episodes, because we don't want to really, we just kind of want to deal with the basic question here first before we start showing the repetitions. But it becomes very quickly apparent that this is not an ordinary kind of a letter. This is super bizarro, like visions galore, right? It's like a dream world. You know, you have a dream state and it's like, did I just have a consecutive, order of my dream that I'm supposed to follow from beginning to end? Or did I have 10 different dreams where some of them are repeating? You know, all those kinds of questions come up when you, at least when I have dreams. I don't know about you, but
So there are even times I wake up and I'm like, am I still in a dream? I hope that was wild.
So scholars have called Revelation a particular genre that we call apocalyptic. And apocalyptic was a very well-known form of literature in the intertestamental time. And even before that, the best examples that we have in the Old Testament, the book of Daniel, parts of the book of Ezekiel, probably parts of the book of Zephaniah. When you read Daniel, you find that it's actually doing some very similar things to Revelation. Yep. It's repeating itself deliberately, intentionally. There's literary structures that are telling you to do that. And when you see that, then you realize that the book is not necessarily meant to be read consecutively. It's what we call cyclical literature. So it's telling a story from the same point of view over and over, or from a different point of view, but it's the same story over and over and over, so that you're getting different glimpses at the same thing. And when you do that, you can tell the story in a way that, you know, it, you can intensify the way that you tell the story. You could zoom in on different parts of that story in the different parts of your book. You can do all kinds of literary things with it that will help people to zoom in on something that they wouldn't otherwise do if you were just writing it chronologically.
Yeah. So there is, we were talking about this beforehand. There's a book that, or there's a movie that came out in 2008 called Vantage Point. So thankfully the movie gives you the key up front in the title, because when you start watching, it's an assassination attempt on the president in Spain. And so when you watch it, it starts as any normal, like, action-packed movie would start, where you've got, like, he's speaking, and then there's an explosion and there's chaos. And then all of a sudden you're now without explanation, without anything, boom, you're like, it's a cut scene and you're at another, and so they're driving in a car and they're getting out of the car and they're walking over here. And you don't realize that it's a repeat of the same scene until the bomb goes off again. That's how you know. When the bomb goes off, you're like, oh, that's not a second bomb, because they showed the same explosion, but they showed it from a different perspective. But it never told you it was going to do that. And then once you see that the second time, you're like, oh, okay. When the third scene cuts and they're on top of the building and it's this, this, and that, you know it's about to happen. It's, you're waiting for the lead up to the explosion. So this is kind of what you're talking about, in that, except for instead of titling the book Vantage Point of Revelation, it's just Revelations, right?
Well, it's the apocalypse, right? I mean, that's what the book is actually called. As you were talking about that, I was reminded of a comedy in the early 90s with Kevin Bacon. He Said, She Said. Have you ever seen that one?
No.
Same idea. Like, you get this story of something that happened, but you don't realize it's being told totally from the dude's point of view. Right. And then halfway through the movie, you're taken back to the beginning. You jarred. You have no idea. And now it's the same exact story, but from her point of view.
Her perspective. Yeah. Gives a different perspective.
Very clever. And you're repeating the exact same events.
Right. So that's the argument of what you're saying, is that when you read Revelation, it's actually giving you perspectives of the apocalypse. Is that what you're arguing?
Exactly. And in fact, our earliest readings in church history of the book of Revelation are cyclical readings. They're not consecutive readings. So
when you say cyclical, I don't know if you want to hop into this now, but what do you mean by cyclical?
Well,
which is okay, the title of the book, right? Circles of Revelation.
Yeah, Rings of Revelation.
Rings.
Yeah, we'll get into that more next time of why I titled it that, but this is part of the reason. So a ring composition is a specific kind of composition that we call it a chiasm, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. The point is that it begins and ends kind of at the same place.
Right.
And so what happens is, in a ring composition, you could theoretically write several different rings and kind of weave them together. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you go and read with a very deliberate thing in your head, that what if this thing is actually repeating itself? Well, you find that, and scholars disagree on how many cycles that there are. Some say four, some say five, some say seven. I like the number seven because it dominates Revelation. You find seven everywhere. Right. Yeah. So the idea would be that chapters 1-3 are giving you a presentation of, you know, in that case, the seven churches. It's a letter to the seven churches. But those seven churches and the things that are said to those seven churches, John, they keep repeating over and over throughout the rest of the book.
And that part's pretty obvious.
And it's wild, man, in some crazy ways that I think about, you know, when you start digging into this, you go, how in the world did a human being write this?
Yeah.
Because it's nutty, man. I mean, you got same exact themes that appear into one church will appear very at the very end of the book and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So then you change it to a different kind of a scene, the vision of the seven seals, chapters 4-7, and then it ends. And then you get chapter 8-11, the seven trumpets, and then it ends. And you could think about the seven things, right? You get the seven trumpets, the seven bowls, the seven this, the seven that. It's like, why is it doing that? Well, it's because in this way of reading it, when you come to the end of one, you're starting a new one, and it's just simply telling you the same thing, but from the perspective, instead of a bowl, it's a trumpet.
Right.
Okay, so there's seven of these. And when you come to the last four of them, especially the last four of them, you start seeing that there are there's wild repeating ideas with regard to a war. Mm-hmm. So Revelation 27-10, we saw that when we read that's a battle. Okay. It's kind of the final battle where Satan is locked up. If you go back and read Revelation 19, the last three verses, which we started that reading with, you find that it's also talking about a battle. And you find that some similar ideas are appearing. So they're being gathered together in both places. It's kings and nations that are being gathered together. You find that there's burning with sulfur and fire in both. You find people are being thrown into the sulfur and fire in both. Mm-hmm. If you go back and you read chapter 16, the very end of chapter 16, which would be the end of the fifth cycle, you find that the same things are happening again. You've got these nations are assembled together at Armageddon. You find that the fury of God's wrath, which is something that you find in the later two as well. Mm-hmm. You find kind of treading on the wine press, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to chapter 14 and you read the end of chapter 14, you find the same stuff yet again. It's the exact same language that you're finding in all of these wars. And so instead of there being for example, Battle of Armageddon, And then you got some kind of period of time that passes between. And then you've got this final war in chapter 19. That's a different war. And then a final war in chapter 20 after the millennium. The idea here is that they're actually all talking about the exact same war. And the clue to that is because he's using the exact same language to describe them.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the idea. So there's like seven of these cycles, and they'll take you from the beginning of a point of view to the end of what they want to do. And generally speaking, they're taking you kind of from the beginning of when John is living until the end of time. And then they go back and they do that from the beginning to the end of time, from the beginning to the end of time. So basically the last 2000 years. There's, you know, like I said, telescoping. So sometimes it'll just focus more on the end. Sometimes it'll focus more on the beginning. And the biggest way that this will happen that you can see that I just find really mind blowing is in chapters 12 and chapter 20.
Okay. So before I'm gonna let you finish there, because the question I'm about to ask you might deter you. So go ahead and finish that thought, and then I'll ask my question.
So you want me to go into chapter 12 and 20?
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe let me ask my question.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so John is writing this in your mind, and you've given us a massive key to reading it. Like, okay, as you read this, be looking for the perspectives, right? Here's the perspective coming from the churches, and then he starts changing. We could say perspective, you could say vantage point, whatever it is, but where the thought process is, we're supposed to be having more data coming at us about this particular, and my question is, what are we reading? Like, what are we supposed to be looking at? What's the point of the book, and why are we reading that? So that as we're thinking about these different vantage points and you get to this end point that you're about to talk about, what are we looking at?
Yeah, so that would have been a great question for the end, because that totally leads into next week, I think, where we can really, really answer that question. But I don't want to answer that question yet, make people mad, you know, like, tell me why it's doing this or whatever, because there's another component to this that just adds layers upon layers of amazingness that I think will answer your question, John. But in order to get there, we have to first just kind of establish that this is a legitimate way of reading this book.
Yeah.
And many, many, many scholars have seen this. So it's not like I'm making this up or anything.
Yeah, this is not new.
No, this is basically the amillennial way of reading the book of Revelation.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go back to finishing the structure and laying the foundation. And all of you who want my question answered, sorry.
Tune in next time.
You got to come next week.
Exactly.
All right. Go ahead.
Okay. So, Revelation 20 you can go all the way through chapter 9, verse 9, Revelation 21 through 9. And you start seeing things like this. You see an angel coming down from heaven that we talked about last time. You see an angel that has seized the dragon. Mm-hmm. You see the dragon and the ancient serpent, who's the devil and Satan. So he's called something very specific there, given four titles. He's thrown into the abyss. Then you start seeing all these people beheaded for the testimony of Jesus and for the word of God. And then they come to life and they reign with Christ.
That reminds me of the Left Behind. Remember the 70s video?
That was the one where the guillotine at the very end of it.
Man, that scarred me in high school.
A Thief in the Night, man. That's what
the
that
Thief
was
in the Night. Yes. The beheadings, man. Oh, I hated that scene. Sorry, go ahead.
That's probably where they get it from.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's why I mentioned it. It's probably this is probably where they got it. Exactly. Because it's toward the end.
You see the dragon is loosed to gather them for battle, surrounding the camp of the saints in the beloved city. And then you see fire coming down from heaven and consuming them. So, you know, seven or eight things that you can just point out there. So when you go and read chapter 12, we might as well read it just for fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
Here's what it says. All right, I won't read the whole thing, but people can go and read it themselves. We'll read up to a certain point. So a great sign appeared in heaven: a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his head 7 diadems. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who's about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. She gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron, but her child was caught up to God into his throne. Now, stop there, because what have we just read? Well, yeah, we've just read the story of the birth of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And then in one very quick swoop, he goes from being a child who rules the nations with a rod of iron to being caught up to God into his throne. That's the ascension. So John has just taken us through all of Christ's life in with one comma, basically. Herod tries to kill him. Satan is going to attack him, and then he's caught up to throne to God's throne where he rules. You know,
isn't that how John writes though? I mean, his birth letter is, and Jesus entered the earth. Looks so, like, well, let's give it some more details.
So that's what we've just read. And notice that we've read about the birth of Christ in chapter 12 of Revelation.
Right.
So this didn't happen back in chapter 1. It's in the middle of the book.
Right.
So in other words, this is a great sign that, in fact, we have gone backwards in time. Mm-hmm. And I think even most people who read on a linear way of reading will go, yeah, I'll concede that.
Right.
But what I'm saying is that, and what many of us are saying in this, the way of reading it, is that this is the way the whole book demands to be read. Once you come to a great battle, and then you start with something else, you're going backwards in time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So he's not using this as an illustration. He's explaining something that's happening or had happened.
He's explaining something that had happened. And then verse 6, where we left off, and the woman fled into the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God in which she is to be nourished for 1260 days. So the woman is a representation here. You know, she's kind of personified in Mary, giving birth to Jesus. But at the same time, she's really kind of the church as a whole, because she's fleeing into the wilderness. Now, some people want to say, well, maybe it's the Jews or something like that. You know, kind of leave that off the table. The point is that the woman becomes a corporate group.
Right.
Okay. Now you get verse 7. Now war arose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon and his angels fought back, and he was defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who's called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and power and kingdom of our God and authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, to whom he accuses them day and night before God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, for they love not their lives even unto death. And then it keeps going. Mm-hmm. Now, we will come back to this definitely next time, because there's so much here that we can't really talk about it all at once. But what I want to point out to people is that in Revelation 20, you see an angel coming down from heaven. In Revelation 12, you see a great sign appearing in heaven. That's how both of these chapters begin.
Right.
Then you see an angel who sees the dragon. And well, in chapter 12, you see Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. In chapter 20, the dragon and the ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan, is mentioned. And again, in chapter 12, it's the exact same thing. In fact, he's given the same exact 4 titles. The only place in all the Bible where you find these 4 titles given to Satan are in Revelation 12 and Revelation 20. They are repeating themselves. Okay. In Revelation 20, he's thrown into the abyss. In Revelation 9, the great dragon is thrown down. Now, remember what we said last time about the abyss, how it's his home. It's Leviathan's home. So it's not, you know, it's that whole thing. If people haven't listened to that, they need to go back and listen to the understanding what these images are that are before you in Revelation chapter 20. But we'll keep going here. So you see thrones and they're reigning in chapter 20, but you see salvation and power and the kingdom of God have come, and the saints are reigning in chapter 12 as well. You find that they're conquering them by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of the testimony. And then you find the exact same thing. They're beheaded for the testimony of Jesus. Mm-hmm. They love not their lives even unto death in chapter 12. They're beheaded in chapter 20. The dragon goes off to make war against the offspring. Well, it's the exact same thing in chapter 20. After he's loosed, he goes off to make war against the church. And then fire comes out of heaven in chapter 20 and consumes them. And then if you keep reading in chapter 12, you see that the earth comes to help and it opens its mouth and swallows the river that the dragon had poured out from his mouth. So my point is that when you read these two chapters in parallel, they're saying the exact same thing, but they're doing it mm-hmm. in slightly different ways. But they're using all kinds of the same language to help you see that, in fact, they are repeating it, a cycle.
Mm. So it's one story, which we'll get to what that story is in a minute, in next week. It's one story that doesn't unfold over chapter 1 through chapter 20. Right, it's actually one story that keeps giving you different perspectives. In other words, think of it being a shorter story. It's not a story that takes place over 20 chapters. It's a story that is much shorter and is explained from all the different perspectives and vantage point and data throughout the 20 chapters. So it keeps So it's unfolding, not new. In other words, as we get to the different chapters, which you break down in your book, You're getting not something that's adding to the story in a new timeline. It's actually going back to the beginning of the timeline, beginning of the story, and saying, here's another way of looking at it. Here's more data to the same event. It's literally like if you were to build a house, you start with the foundation, then you go to the walls, and then you go to the doors and the ceiling. That happens over 20 chapters.
Yeah, exactly. You're building the framework of your wall. Okay. You've put that wall mm-hmm. in. Well, now you have to go back to the wall and you have to put the drywall on it. And then you have to go back to the drywall and you have to texture it. And then you have to go mm-hmm. back to the drywall and you have to paint it. So you keep going over and over to the same thing, but it looks different every time that you do it.
Right. So when you get to the end, then you have the whole thing.
When you get to the end, you have the whole thing. And the last two chapters are really kind of standing as standalone, in the book of Revelation, but also standalone because they're taking you really back to the beginning of the Bible to show that the whole Bible is bringing you from the Garden of Eden back to a greater garden, sort of an idea. So really
play a little advocate here. So Doug, if you don't read it this way and you decide to read it linear, what's going to end up happening?
Okay. So what you have in a linear reading is a very literalistic, extreme way of doing it would be the Left Behind series, that kind mm-hmm. of a thing.
Right.
So you have kind of a map given for this timeline of something that's coming in our very near future, usually the 7-year tribulation. And then all the details are laid out for how the tribulation is going to unfold. And at the end of the tribulation, you have this war. And then Jesus returns to live physically on the earth as in the way that they read it. Now, and then after that 1,000 years is over, then you have Satan being let loose, then you have another war that takes place after the millennium, and then kind of the second coming happens after that.
Right. So it really changes. I mean, it's fair to say.
Well, I don't even know if it would be called the second coming, right? Because the second coming for that view is actually when he comes at the beginning of the millennium, right?
That's right. That's absolutely right. So there's a third coming.
I don't know what else to call it because it's kind of strange.
Right. So if you end up not using what it seems to be the structure that John, I mean, pretty obvious, we're going to get into more of this next week for sure. But this is not an unusual way of reading apocalyptic language. You already argued that in the Old Testament, John would have known the Old Testament. He would have known of Daniel. He would have understood how that type of language works. So when John writes his letter, he's using a form that people would be familiar with. For instance, Doug, when you and I hear someone speak or we start reading something and we understand that there's 6 words and the first sentence and the second sentence end up having words that match in tone, what do we typically understand that to be? It's a poem. Like, oh, all of a sudden, you're reading this and there's a flow of thought and there's a point to it. But the way in which it works is that it also rhymes and it has a connection to it. And so we wouldn't understand, oh, I'm reading a poem. So if John is writing this and he's writing it to the believer, he starts using a structure, they should go, oh, John's writing apocalyptic. And so in their mind, that triggers, I'm going to read it this way. That's the argument you're making.
Exactly. And this was a very, very popular form of genre and literature at the time of Jesus. I mean, we have many apocalyptic books. And by the way, folks, they were never in the Bible. They were not lost books that somebody took out at Nicaea. They're simply Jewish books that were never considered scripture, that were interesting takes on usually famous men from the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. And then the Christians started doing the same thing with the guys from the New Testament. So we have all kinds of apocalyptic literature that shows us that this is a very different form of writing, of telling people a story than mm-hmm. really what we are accustomed to thinking of, unless you use those kind of movie examples that we find every once in a while coming out of Hollywood.
Right, which we'll talk about. Anyways, so this is, I think, something, Doug, that has been so powerful and helpful to a lot of people. The culture and literature influenced the writers of the Bible. I mean, Paul used culture a lot, and he used literature a lot, and so did Peter. So it's not wrong to understand and look at, okay, what was going on in the culture at that time? What was popular literature at the time? How did they, I mean, we do this, Doug, when we're trying to understand words, because there are times where there's a Greek word in the New Testament that's only used once, and we're like, well, how else was it used in popular writings so we can get a proper understanding?
Right.
You know, I was thinking about the song, you and I were talking about this, God Rest You Merry Gentlemen. And that song originally was written like back in the 17th century, like 1650, I think it goes back. Have you done any research on this psalm at all? I know you and I were talking about it. Have you done any research on this
psalm? I thought it was 18th century, but 17th is probably right.
Well, it goes back. It's popular printing that we know today is the 1800s, 18th century. But even the word merry, gentlemen, and rest, God rest you, like those words had different meanings back then to how we understand them. And so it's healthy. Like, you know, you can even think about words today. I mentioned this, to say that I am gay today and to say I am gay 100 years ago.
Or even in the Flintstones, because we'll have a gay old time.
Have a gay old time. That's right. Meet the Flintstones. Right. Wow, I totally forgot about that. But it means happy, right? So to say that there wasn't a genre or structure that the guys, the writers like John would use for his readers, saying they would understand this, they would feel this. I had one recently in Second Peter. Peter uses a Roman concept where it talks about entering into the kingdom like richly. That's how the Roman soldiers would come back. I mean, this Peter's writing to the provinces of Rome, and they know how the soldiers came back. And so Peter uses that word picture. We don't know it because we don't live in Rome. We don't think about Roman culture, but they would do this all the time. They would make these little, you know, at the end of his first letter, Peter says coming from those who are of Babylon. Well, Babylon hadn't existed for hundreds of years. He's making a reference to something that the writers would have been aware of. And the reason I'm going on this long dialogue here is because I think it's important to understand that one, this is this style of reading, the style of writing was definitely used in the Old Testament. During the time that John is writing, it was a popular genre. It was something that people were used to. So they would have picked up on it right away. Oh, this is what John's doing. He's telling us this story, which we're going to get to next episode. And he's explaining it from these vantage points, which then leads us to next week, Doug. What are we talking about next week?
Well, let's try and answer your question about why, what does this mean? You know, how does this mean that we're supposed to read it in terms of its impact on us today? And I think that people will be just completely blown away by what we'll talk about, especially if you've never heard me talk about it on another podcast.
So you're saying there's a contrast, there's a different way of reading. So we're not looking for the 7-year tribulation and 1,000-year reign and a rebuilding of the temple. That would be one person's interpretation that kind of came about in the last 200 years. You're saying there's an older interpretation. And
well, to be fair, the premillennial interpretation has been around since Justin and Irenaeus in the 2nd century.
True. I guess the rapture.
Yeah, the rapture stuff, that's been only the last couple hundred years. So the church has disagreed on how to read this book for a long time. It's not as clear as, you know, to everybody as what I think it is to me. And we can agree to disagree on this, but I just want people to see that this is how we read the book. And we think that there's a lot of internal clues on how to read it. And we're going to show you some more next week that will add to what we've looked at here today that I think, for me, it just kind of cements it. I mean, the Revelation 12 and 20 parallels, that right there is just massive for people to just go and read that. But when you add what we're going to talk about next week to it, it's a mind blower.
So, little advertisement. I know a lot of people like to read the book of Revelation and hold the newspaper in their hand at the same time and try and match the two and see if the events are going to line up. And some would even say, Doug, that what you and I are arguing for is only fits in one particular camp, like the Reformed camp, which I'm going to argue, I don't think so. So stay tuned. We're going to tell you what the book is about and what the structure of it is and how it affects our life and what's the purpose of it. So that's a big promise, Doug. I hope we can deliver. All right. Hey, guys, thanks for listening. If you haven't gone back, I would listen to our entire series on Revelation that we've kind of been building and adding to it so far. Get Doug's books. They're available on Amazon. Just go to Amazon and type in Doug Van Dorn. You'll see it'll pop right up. Leave them a review. We'd love more people to be encouraged by this book and less confused, because I promise you what I love about Doug's writings and what I love about this podcast, the point is Jesus. We are always being led back to the wonder and the glory of Jesus Christ. And if that is not the point of your life and the point of reading the Bible, then we're here to help you see that the supernatural nature and the point is Jesus Christ. And we'll leave you with that. Lord willing, we'll be around his throne together and never listening to a podcast again. But if that's not the case, we'll have another podcast up for you next week.